I'll call to order the Senate Committee on General Government, Consumer, and Small Business Protection Committee. Today is Wednesday, May 11th. I usually begin by saying, colleagues, this is what we're going to do today, but I'll refrain from that since we are still working on finding our quorum. But I figured what we would do is jump into the bill that had the most testimony first, which is House Bill 2425A. We will jump into that in just a moment. Then we will go, once we get a quorum, then we'll move into House Bill 3000A, then to 3195A, then to 2916A, then 2770A, and 2825A, and then we will do the work session on House Bill 2212A last. Make sense?
You just wanted to wait until we have members here to take testimony. Is that what it was? Because I would suggest starting with the one that we have the legislators in the room.
My concern is that then I see what you're saying. Okay. Actually, I'm going to revise that decision since I'll try to jump in and get the legislators back to their committees first. And instead of doing 2425A first, we'll start with 3000A first, and the rest of the order will remain the same. And we'll see where we are when it comes to the quorum. So I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3000A. Patrick, could you tee it up for us?
Sure, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3000A allows contracting agencies to pay up to 10% more for goods fabricated or processed or services performed entirely within the state, with the exception of specified public improvements and construction contracts. It allows contracting agencies to give further preference to bidder or proposer that resides or is headquartered in Oregon if more than one bidder or proposer qualifies for the 10% preference. It allows contracting agencies to set a preference higher than 10% if the agency finds good cause. The measure has an emergency clause, would take effect upon passage and signature by the governor. Now, there is a fiscal statement issued that's in your packet. No revenue impact, no amendments on the measure, and the measure passed the House on a vote of 51-0.
Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senators. I was hoping to shed a little light on the status of my mother-in-law's life status, too, but no one's here for my joke, so I'll just introduce myself and talk about the bill. I'm Brian Clem, State Representative from here in Salem, District 21. And House Bill 3000, as Patrick mentioned, passed the House floor unanimously, and the General Government Consumer Protection Committee that I serve on as well. And what the bill essentially does is allows the contracting agencies in the state, which would be state agencies, school districts, local governments, to change slightly the current preference statutes for their purchasing of goods and services. What current statute basically does, with the exception of ag products, it requires that a bid has to be an exact tie before you could look to awarding a preference to an Oregon entity versus an out-of-state entity or international entity, you know, selling like these chairs, for example, that we're sitting in. So if it's a tie between, you know, China Inc. and the local Hillsboro chairmaker, you could give it to the Oregon chairmaker. But if it was 1 cent more for the guy in Hillsboro who makes chairs than some entity from out of the country, you had to give it to the out-of-country bidder. And so sometimes there's another factor in there, like local employment and other things, that might be something a contracting agency would want to consider, other than purely just low bid, something that is of additional values. We have a program here in Salem at my Chamber of Commerce called Buy in Salem, Watch What Happens, Job, Jobs, Jobs. We try and promote, you know, consumer purchasing. In this case, the consumer is the state of Oregon. So we're not trying to influence other people's behavior when they're purchasing things. That would be a violation of interstate commerce clause, but we are acting as a market participant, just buying things ourselves. And so the House obviously felt that it was in our interest to have some more flexibility for agencies. Thanks. This is a modeled after the ag statute that we did last session. So when it comes to ag, this is already in place. We already have this exact same policy, and the way the bill is written actually just modifies to morph the ag products into all other products except construction and contracting related to construction. So construction is not covered by what I just described. That still is under its own whole procurement system. But anything else would be the way the bill's structured. If the agency wants to, it's not mandatory, if the agency wants to buy from an Oregon-based entity, they may, if it's within 10% of the low bid, without having to do anything other than just do the contract. If it's above 10% of the low bid, they have to do a written finding describing why they're paying over 10% and what the advantages are, you know, local employment or it's different quality product or something like that. And what we've heard from the Department of Administrative Services about the ag statute is as they carefully wrote their procurement laws, as they implemented the bill, they've actually got agencies competing now to see who can buy the most local, and they actually keep track of who's buying farm products and fish from Oregon-based growers and Oregon fishermen and women, fisher people. And so they have a little contest, apparently, to who can buy more from Oregon. And I just think all of that is good, given you know, the need to have an efficient contracting system, but also facts are some of us pay minimum wage and follow environmental rules that our competitors don't from other countries, and it's hard to compete with them on pure price alone when, you know, we're providing free housing for people who work in our orchard and we pay, above the minimum wage and a good wage, and then I have to compete with some guy from Argentina who doesn't pay hardly anything, and it's awkward to know that state government and my tax dollars might be used to purchase products from a competitor who isn't interested in following the same laws I am, because in their country they don't have those same laws. So one way is to reduce all of our laws, get rid of our minimum wage, get rid of our environmental rules. The other is to try and
that's his way.
At least support our at least support our own companies as it pertains. You may recall the deal with the license plates where for many years they were made in Portland, and then our Oregon license plate contract got awarded to some country. I think it was in Canada. And the governor ordered it back by executive order at the time because there was such an angry outcry from citizens about having our Oregon license plate made not in this country. And this is, again, not mandatory, but would allow agencies to be able to factor in an Oregon preference. And we didn't want to make it mandatory, A, because there might be a higher cost, and that's something the agency has to think about when they're purchasing. And B, there would be some issues potentially with reciprocity where we may make a product here that somebody in Oregon sells to other state governments, and they may not want to have their product preferenced in Oregon because it could hurt them. It could actually hurt them in their sales around the country. And so this would be more on a product-by-product, agency-by-agency basis rather than mandatory policy for the state that you have to buy Oregon even if you don't want to help get around the reciprocity issue of causing some entity a problem who does a lot of government sales and around the country. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Question, Senator George.
Representative Clinton, the reason I have a problem with these kind of bills is take this to the logical extreme. Okay, so if Oregon state government decided, and Oregonians decided we were only going to buy from Oregon companies, and Washington companies decided that only they're going to buy from Washington companies, Idaho did the same thing, California did the same thing, what ends up happening is everybody's costs go up, and this still is one country. You know, I mean, we still depend on Vancouver. We still... those are Americans to me, and so I don't mind them having jobs. And so what I'm a little nervous about is you take this to the logical exclusion, and you just talked about just buy Salem. My business is in Newark, right? So you don't buy from me and you pay a higher price. At some point, what you do is you run everybody's costs up, then I don't see the net benefit. It actually seems like a net reduction because then everybody has less dollars to go out and buy more products. So it seems like to me that what you'd want to do is make it so that you get everybody does the most efficient thing, and then Oregonians who have a high level of education are innovative, are creative, create businesses that can compete with everybody else. So it seems like to me you take this 10% extra cost and you invest that in education, you'd be way better off than to invest it in an artificial market barrier.
Thank you, Senator. I would try and sell that concept to any grower in Oregon who has to compete with a foreign country who has no minimum wage and no standards and see if they think they're not efficient enough, and that's the problem, is that they're not efficient enough. Those of us in the in the private sector world who do compete with other states, probably not as big of a deal. You know, we have a similar set of national laws, like you say. I mean, I'm a little bit Oregon sort of xenophobic. I don't really. I actually like to secede from the union if I couldn't just have Oregon. But your point is valid if taken to the logical extreme. I feel nothing. This bill
is that in this bill?
What's that?
Secession.
Yeah, secession's right in there. It's on line section 8. But nothing in this bill requires us to only buy from Oregon. It requires it says if an agency finds some extra value in buying from an Oregon entity instead of let's use Washington instead of a Washington entity, then and even though it's going to cost more, clearly that's the whole point of the bill. It may cost more than the absolute low bid. If there's some other value, like that creates 60 jobs here, and in Washington it creates zero jobs for Oregon, there's going to be that multiplier effect in the local economy that will bring in enough revenue to make up for the cost. But our system of analyzing revenue impacts doesn't seem to capture a multiplier effect of doing the work here versus doing the work somewhere else. So everything looks like a pure expense, but the multiplier effect is left out of our legislative revenue office formula.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to get at is that if everybody did what you said, so if Washington retaliates, those 60 jobs to make product X may be in Vancouver, but product Y may create 100 jobs in Oregon. So you're sacrificing that. So Washington State wants to buy something from a company that makes X. They'll create 100 jobs here, where we're only buying products that create 60 jobs in Vancouver. It seems like to me we could have a net loss under your same exact logic. And what I'm trying to get at is that I get into this whole thing where right now we're trying to figure out how to limit costs, and I see that there's an actual, for every dollar for dollar, there's a potential negative for this bill, and that's what I'm trying to get over.
Yeah.
And plus you're spending 10% more.
Well, again, Senator Shields, Senator George, it's not mandatory. So there's no automatic cost. That's why you have no revenue, because it's discretionary. But if an agency did want to buy from an Oregon company and they exercise the preference, it would cost more than the low bid. That is the whole point. And again, the analysis of cost, not factoring in other values like a multiplier effect in the local community by having, you know, let's say my computer business wanted to do business with city government doing some IT work for them. And maybe I'm going to build computers for them, for example. And they instead buy from Dell versus me. Dell's CEO, Michael Dell, he doesn't buy a car in Oregon. He doesn't own a house in Oregon. He doesn't spend his money in Oregon. I do. You know, I'm not going to leave here over not getting a contract. Dell might. There's a factor for people who own businesses and are headquartered here and live here that's just not factored into these formulas. And so all that other spin-off activity has to somewhere count against that, you know, extra cents per dollar on the bid when I'm, you know, I can't compete with Dell, obviously, on volume, so that's not really the issue. But could I get close to the price? Yeah. Let's say their computer's $400 and mine's $405. Current law says, sorry, got to go with Dell, even though you could be helping an Oregon business. And yeah, it's $5 more computer per computer, but you know, I'm here to help Oregon-based Oregon small businesses. If I thought this was hurting Oregon small businesses because they were going to lose contracts to Washington that they need, I would advocate that they not have, you know, that the DAS does not use this bill in that industry category. This is something that is very popular with the chambers of commerce around the state because a lot of them they're not able to compete at the lowest common denominator that other countries are, or they can't compete on pure volume basis like great big, like the Dells and Walmarts of the world. And so it's a way to possibly advantage some Oregon businesses to help them in what's pretty tough economic times.
It looks like we just might have a difference of opinion, which is fine. But we are going to need to move on. Any questions from the committee? All right.
Earlier I noted my mother-in-law is still alive, in case anybody was wondering. I haven't seen you in a while.
They'll be glad to know that in the Ways and Means Committee, where 719 is currently residing. All right. Thank you, Representative Clem. Could we please bring up Steve Buckstein and Marcy Stone?
Good
from the committee. Go ahead.
Senator Shields, Senator George, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Marcy Stone. I'm with the State Procurement Office with the Department of Administrative Services. And we see House Bill 3000A expands an existing preference for agricultural products produced and transported within Oregon by permitting the contracting agency to give preference to procure goods produced or services performed in Oregon. The preference may apply if the cost of such goods or services is not 10% greater than the goods or services not produced or performed in the state of Oregon. An agency may set a higher percentage with a determination. We are supportive of this bill. We appreciate its flexibility. Each agency may decide a cost allowance up to 10% or higher with a determination, and this decision may vary among agency solicitations. What follows this testimony are preferences and current preferences in Oregon statutes, just for your information, and including the 2009 agricultural products preference, which is the predecessor to this House Bill 3000A. In summary, DAS is supportive of House Bill 3000A. We thank you for your time, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions? Steve, welcome to the committee.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, my name is Steve Buckstein. I'm Senior Policy Analyst and founder of Cascade Policy Institute in Portland. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization. And I'm here to oppose this bill because I believe that it's bad public policy and that it will set a bad example for the future. Not so much that it's going to have a huge detrimental impact economically right now, but I want to, as a think tank, I don't have to vote on these things and don't have to incur the wrath of my constituents. So I want to just give you a little bit of economics of why this is bad public policy. The governor said in his news release when the bill passed the House, he said, "This bill will help Oregon businesses by encouraging the development and growth of our local supply chains, which will help create local jobs and revitalize our state's economy," unquote. But economists for centuries have uncovered the fallacy of this kind of thinking, and I think one who I don't agree with on everything, but one who said it best is Henry George in 1886, and I'd like to quote him. He said, "If to prevent trade were to stimulate industry and promote prosperity, then the localities where man was most isolated would show the first advances. The natural protection to home industry afforded by rugged mountain chains, by burning deserts, or by seas too wide and tempestuous for the early mariner would have given us the first glimmers of civilization and shown its most rapid growth. But in fact, it is where trade could be best carried out that we find wealth first accumulating and civilization beginning. It is on accessible harbors, by navigable rivers, and much-traveled highways that we find cities arising and the arts and sciences developing," unquote. And note that, you know, the biggest city with economic activity in the state was located on two navigable rivers, Portland. It was done for that way, I think, for a reason, because the early settlers realized that they needed to trade with other people. They didn't want to be isolated and only trading among themselves. I'm afraid that any jobs that will be created from this bill will simply be offset by other jobs that are lost, but you won't see what jobs are lost and other lost opportunities. You will see jobs that might be created because someone sells a computer for $405, as the earlier example, but you won't see the fact that if the state is spending more on those computers, it has to spend less on something else. And while the choices may benefit some Oregon producers, I think in general, as economists over the centuries have found, it will harm virtually all Oregon consumers. Another quote, Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations in 1776, he said, "Consumption is the sole end and purpose of all production, and the interest of the producers ought to be attended to only insofar as it may be necessary for promoting that of the consumer," unquote. James Glassman, an author, journalist, pointed to that quote and said that the great lesson for all policymakers, you being policymakers, to bear in mind, ask the question, does this policy help consumers?
What is better for consumers is always better for the economy. It is indeed true that some producers are hurt by free trade or not having this preference in the case of Oregon. And we can expect producers to kick and scream over free trade. Fine, he says, but consumers benefit mightily, unquote. So I think everyone, in conclusion, everyone in this building wants to create jobs, wants to find ways to create jobs. But the economic record for centuries, since mercantilism and before, since the 15th century probably and before, has shown that these kind of protections, in this case of Oregon producers opposed to Oregon consumers, in the long run don't work, and they set a bad precedent. And so I'm here to hopefully encourage you not to set that bad precedent. Thank you.
Questions? Did you put him up this? Thank you very much.
You read the same economic text that I did, probably.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. Let's see. Would anybody else like to testify on House Bill 3000A? All right. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3000A, and I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3195A is Representative Esquivel. There he is. Representative Esquivel. Patrick, can you tee it up for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 3195 authorizes county clerks to record instruments presented as electronic images or by electronic means, including recordings made before the measure's effective date. It allows county clerks to enter into contracts to receive instruments as electronic images or electronic means with a contractor that presents the instruments on behalf of others. The measure has an emergency clause, would take effect upon passage. No fiscal or revenue on the measure, no amendments to the measure, and the measure passed 56-0 in the House. Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6, Medford. You have in front of you, in my opinion, is a catch-up bill. It's a catch-up to technology. Today in the real estate industry, we can, in fact, wire thousands and thousands of dollars for a closure of a house. We can do electronic signatures. And yet, today, we haven't really justified or allowed, legally, I guess one would say, to put it in the statute, a recordation of a document for a closing. What this does is it allows us to electronically record the document and go about your business without making a run to your local county clerk. And it also allows you to do technology instead of sending a person to the courthouse as a example, a title company, you can electronically record that document, which makes it not only simpler, but it makes it more efficient as well as it saves trips on our roads. That's about it. It's a pretty simple bill.
Well put. Go ahead. I'm not sure who you are.
Yes. Alan Brickley. Yeah.
Alan Brickley. Mr. Chairman, Alan Brickley, members of the committee. I am an attorney. I am employed by First American Title Insurance Company in Portland, Oregon, and I'm here speaking on behalf of the title industry, the Oregon Land Title Association. It is a technical correction. There is a difference of opinion as to whether or not electronic recording is permitted currently in Oregon. And that's based primarily on the statutory provision that requires that an original signature be viewed by the county clerk. All this does is to correct that and allows the county clerk to receive this electronic version of a recorded or of a document to be recorded and to also authorize those which have already been recorded. It's been happening in Jackson County for a little while. And there's a lawsuit that's pending, and this would moot that lawsuit as well.
Does this have anything to do with MERS at all?
It has absolutely nothing to do with MERS.
Okay. The right answer.
I believe all of the interested parties, would include the county clerks, the title association, are all in favor of the change.
Okay. All right, good. Thank you very much for your testimony, gentlemen. I think we've got two more. No, one more. Michael Elias. Thank you.
Very cool. Chair Shields, members of the committee, Michael Eisen with the Association of Oregon Counties, here today, just briefly representing the county clerks. Also with me is Clackamas County Clerk Sherry Hall, should you have any questions that would be directed sort of technically towards a clerk. But all I'm... I'm here simply to say that we did work on the amendments with the title companies. Everyone is in agreement, and we fully support the bill. It would sort of ratify what's already going on, and we view it as sort of an effective technical correction. Thanks.
Just here's a resource.
Okay. Well, I'm just here to say that all the county clerks support the bill also.
Okay, and could you identify yourself just for the record?
My name is Sherry Hall, Clackamas County Clerk.
Thank you. We appreciate your coming. Appreciate your work on this bill. Questions? All right.
Thanks.
Anybody else like to testify on House Bill 3195A? I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3195A. And let's see. Why don't I jump? We need Barnhart.
We call him. Do that one next to Representative Wickers right
now. Okay. Is he here?
Yeah,
oh, he is here. Okay. And I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2916A.
I'll just
let you. Representative Wingert, welcome to the committee, and we'll let you testify, and then Patrick can tell us what the bill does after that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Pat Wingert, House District 26. The bill before you is elegant in its simplicity, but vitally important to thousands of Oregonians. I was actually brought an issue from a realtor in my district who was holding the hand of a lot of homeowners going through short sales, and wanted to do something to make life a little bit easier for those folks. And so I asked the realtors and the bankers to get together and work through the issue, and they spent many months doing that. And what we ended up focusing on that I think has produced a pretty good product here is this issue of the 1099-C, an IRS form that that the bank will mail to the former homeowner, alerting them to the fact that the bank has made the decision to write off the residual debt from the short sale, and that the homeowner or former homeowner no longer owes the money. The catch in the law currently, and what we're seeking to fix, is that actually the bankers have a number of years, I think it's up to three, to change their mind and decide that the former homeowner has assets that they would like to pursue. So then they just simply refile their taxes. They make that change, take that deduction back, and then go and pursue the former homeowner. What we do in this bill is tell the bankers that they have to make a choice. If they make the choice to write off the debt and they send the 1099-C to the homeowner, or former homeowner at this point, that's irrevocable. And the homeowner can count on that, or former homeowner can count on that, and can move on with their life, and they do not have to be looking over their shoulder over the next few years wondering if the bank will change its mind and decide to come and pursue the asset. So I think we're going to provide some much-needed relief and allow some folks to move on, and hopefully one day, we hope, I'm sure all of us, that they will be homeowners again. And I can tell you that both the realtors and the bankers have agreed to support the bill, and I think the representative from the bankers has been pulled into some other meeting and just isn't with us today, but he wanted me to express that on his behalf. I don't usually represent the bankers. and I think someone from the realtors is here, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
Yep. Sounds like you did some really good work on this, Representative. Thank you. Gary Oxley?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Gary Oxley, Oxley & Associates, appearing before you this afternoon on behalf of the Oregon Association of Realtors. The testimony that's being handed out is that of Sean Jillians, who has been advocating this issue on behalf of the realtors. I'm not going to spend the time going into his testimony. I'm simply going to say that this is a consensus bill. The Oregon Association of Realtors definitely supports it. I think one of the important things for the committee to recognize is this did come out of the House unanimously. Today, there are a quarter of Oregonians who are upside down on their mortgages. That means that the value of their mortgage is far more than the value of the property. Now, that doesn't mean that today they're in default, but it means that we are approaching a very critical issue with a lot of Oregonians in this state. In fact, in August of last year, one in 397 homes in the state of Oregon was in default. or was receiving a foreclosure notice. So those numbers aren't decreasing, unfortunately. We're seeing an increase. You've been following the articles on the real estate industry and the nationwide and in the state of Oregon. You'll know that there are more foreclosures taking place. We have not hit bottom yet in terms of the value of home decline, and we have a critical situation facing us. I think Representative Wingard has brought forward an outstanding bill that provides clarity for people in terms of making a decision in which way they want to go. Today, it's far easier for someone to go into foreclosure than it is for a short sale, and unfortunately, that's there's a very significant impact to their credit rating for doing that. So the bill that is before you is an excellent piece of legislation, and on behalf of the 14,000 realtors in the state of Oregon, we encourage you to pass the bill.
Good. Any questions? Good. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for bringing this forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2916 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2770.
2025, I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. Let me close the public hearing on House Bill 2770 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2825. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2825 directs state agencies to submit information about tax expenditures that have a purpose connected to referenced economic development to the Department of Administrative Services for posting on the Oregon Transparency website. It applies to applications for tax expenditures approved or certified by state agencies in fiscal years ending on or after June 30th, 2011. The measure will take effect on the 91st day following adjournment, sine die of the Legislative Assembly. No revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact, no amendment, Mr. Chair, and the House vote was 59-0.
Representatives, who's next?
I guess I'll go first. I'm Kim Thatcher, representative from House District 25, Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburg. And I think, just so you know, we did all the amendments over there. I think we ended up with the -9 being incorporated into the original bill. But earlier this week, there was another bill before this committee that would enhance the Oregon Transparency website by adding the Treasurer's Office and the public meeting notices for the state. And this is another important component for the Transparency website. This bill will help legislators as well as the taxpayers get a better understanding of how resources are being spent at the state level. This bill would take information about the hundreds of millions of dollars we spend on tax subsidies for economic development projects and then post that information on the website. I think this will help us make better decisions in the future regarding these tax incentives and also boost citizen confidence in their state government. It simply takes information that's already public record and already available in various and sundry and scattered reports and put them in one place on the Transparency website. That website was designed to show Oregonians the revenue coming into the state as well as the expenditures that we make on state programs. The tax subsidies listed in the bill make up a significant chunk of the state budget and should be posted on the website along with the other items we spend money on. Being on Ways and Means for the first time this year has given me a wake up as to how important it is to know how we're spending our money. And also, since I'm a business owner, I have a little bit of a unique perspective in that I know it's hard to survive out there in the private sector in this recession. I know that sometimes a government incentive can pay off for a business, but I also believe that the taxpayers footing the bill for these economic development projects, well, they have a right to know where their money's going and if it's being effective and it's being put to good use, because let's face it, the government is in this case in the position of picking winners and losers out there by taking money from one taxpayer and shifting it over to another. And these taxpayers deserve to see what's going on. And in getting this bill through the House, not only do we have 8 or 9 amendments, whatever it was, we work with several members of the business lobby, and I think somebody's here representing them today, just to ensure that their concerns were addressed in the bill. We also worked closely with the Department of Administrative Services, so there would be no impact, a fiscal impact to the bill. And I think it's a constituent of mine from Newburgh summed it up really well. He just said, in times like these, when we have record unemployment and a huge state budget deficit, it's critically important to know if the hundreds of millions of dollars Oregon spends on economic development programs are working. It passed the House unanimously, and I'm hoping it can do the same thing on the side. Thanks.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Phil Barnhart. I represent House District 11 in the Oregon House of Representatives. I'm not going to repeat what my colleague has already stated, but simply note that the issue came up as a result of attempts on the part of those trying to bird dog the various tax expenditures that the state makes through various agencies and finding that they were spending a considerable amount of time and a considerable number of dollars on public records requests. This bill is built in such a way that these things can be posted as they come up. The particular requirements that look like they might be onerous are actually boilerplate. There are things that could be written ahead of time and simply with numbers stuck into them. And the result of the way in which we finally got with the dash nines down was that there was essentially no extra work to be done, although I think the bill does allow for an agency to add additional information in order for someone reading the website who didn't really understand the issue to do that if they wanted to, in addition to the things that are required by the bill. The bill doesn't require them to produce any information that they don't already have.
Sounds good. Questions? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
John Bartholomew and Jim Craven.
Another
uncouple. All right. Thank you. Chair Shields, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Bartholomew, policy advocate at the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, OSPIRG. I don't need to elaborate more on the bill because the sponsors did an excellent job of presenting exactly what it's about and why it's about it. I've presented some written testimony for you, as well as I submitted a letter from a number of business owners in this state who actually utilize many of these incentives, whether it's the Betsy Enterprise Zones, the e-commerce Enterprise Zones, and they all agree that, you know, for accountability purposes and for the public to know how their tax dollars are being spent, transparency is a good thing. We full-heartedly support this bill, and I've been very pleased to be working with the co-sponsors and with folks in the business community to come up with a consensus bill that we all seem to agree on. As a member also of the Transparency Oregon Advisory Commission, which oversees the implementation of the state transparency website, this is going to do a lot more to provide a bigger, wholer picture of how the state spends its money. So with that, thank you, and I'll pass along.
Jim.
Senator, Chair Shields, members of the committee, Jim Craven, representing Tech America and sort of by proxy several other folks in the business community. At the original public hearing in the House on this bill, I and a couple of others, business lobbyists, testified and had some concerns about the original text of the bill. We were asked to make a good faith effort to see what we could do. We suggested a few mainly technical changes. They were adopted graciously by the sponsors of the bill. I think we had one half-hour meeting, and I think business issues were resolved in only one of those nine dashes. So I think a lot of state agencies were more responsible for dash 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 than we were. We believe in transparency, and we think that shining public light on economic development incentives will, we believe, will demonstrate that they help improve our economic environment and help local communities. So we applaud the sponsors and OSPIRG for bringing this bill and making it a reality, and we look forward to seeing the results. I think this bill, along with the hard work being done by the Joint Committee on Tax Credits that's really digging into these individually on a policy basis rather than a transparency basis, is going to make some difference over the coming months and years, and so we support the bill. Thank you very much.
Great questions. Senator George.
I just think John was being fairly modest. You didn't read your testimony into the record, and I want to pull out one paragraph that John had in his testimony, if you could. Oregon taxpayers spent at least $350 million last biennium through the tax code on programs designed to promote economic development. Based on the new tax expenditure report, this amount could increase to about $600 million in the next biennium. That doesn't include stuff that's off budget, like the public purpose charge. I just think it's time that even as policymakers, we have some kind of idea what's going on. And, John, I appreciate you putting highlighting that in your testimony. So it's definitely time that this gets more scrutiny, and not just from transparency, but policy-wise. So.
Yeah. I think we finally have common ground between Osberg, myself, Senator George, and Steve Buckstein.
All right. Mission accomplished.
Mission accomplished. All right. Thank you very much
for your testimony.
Gentlemen. And I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2825A, and I think I will open the work session on House Bill 2825A. Mm-hmm. Senator George?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2825A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved House Bill 2825A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Senator George?
I'd just like to thank, obviously, the sponsors of the bill. I know Representative Thatcher, because we do a lot of town halls together, has constantly talked about transparency. When she first started working on these bills, I didn't think she was going to get very far, and I think she's done a great job, and obviously Representative Barnhart also. Thank you guys very much for bringing that. This is great stuff you're sending over to us on this transparency website, and thank you guys very much.
Yeah, likewise. Further discussion? Debbie, could you please call the roll?
Senator Bonamici?
Excused.
Senator Boquist?
Excused.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. And Senator George, would you like to carry the bill? I'm getting used to your floor speeches on this topic.
You really want my tirade on?
Keep them coming. I will close the work session on House Bill 2025A. And again, Senator George will carry that bill. And I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2770A. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 2770 came through the House with a vote of 46-12. No revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact, no amendments. The measure requires the Business Development Department to explore the feasibility of establishing a business ombudsman to provide specific information on the website related to new or prospective small businesses and methods by which small businesses could ask questions or direct complaints regarding doing business in Oregon. It specifies that such information be located either on the department's website or another state agency's website. It requires the department to report to the Legislative Assembly with conclusions on the feasibility study no later than the convening of the 2013 regular session of the Legislative Assembly. Mr. Chair.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Kim Thatcher, House District 25, Salem, or not yet Salem, but Kaiser Newburgh in St. Paul. I'm in Salem now. This bill has the potential to start the ball rolling anyhow to help many Oregon businesses that have a tough time navigating the often choppy waters of state bureaucracy. When the bill was first introduced, it would have required the governor to appoint a business ombudsman. Simple. And that business ombudsman would have been a troubleshooter. And that troubleshooter would help the businesses when they encounter problems with state agencies. You know, we have obviously high unemployment, and we continually hear complaints about companies in Oregon saying, you know, it's just not very business friendly here. I hear it. I've experienced it. Unfortunately, I think it's time that we did something positive that would actually assist businesses, and this would get that ball rolling. And we're working this bill through on the other side. We had discussions about the many ombudsmen that we have at the state level. One would be the long-term care ombudsman, and they've been here for many years at the state level doing really good work with helping seniors maneuver various issues dealing with long-term care. There's also an ombudsman-type program called the Governor's Advocacy Office, and many of us in the legislature turn to them for help with constituents with concerns with the social services. There is a small business ombudsman, but they are assigned only at this point to work on workers' comp issues, and that's it. 14 other states already have a business ombudsman program. There's even one at the federal level right now, and we had very positive feedback from the business community and from folks having to deal with business development issues. But a business development department came back and told us it would take four positions and $800,000 to set up such a program. We're hoping we could just shift how business is done in the department, but it would, they were seeing it as an additional thing to do rather than just changing. So after working with the governor's office and the agency, we came up with, okay, let's just start small. And so that's what this bill does. We're starting out with a feasibility study, and I choke when I say that because a feasibility study often it's just very low key, but it gets the ball rolling, and hopefully they will come back with a decision as to, they being the business development folks, they would come back with a decision on where it would be best to house this, whether it's within their department or whether it is appointed within the governor's office, which is what we were originally intending, or whether it's housed maybe in the legislative branch. It might be some other agency we haven't even thought of, don't know. We're just trying to figure out, this would help them do that. They would decide where this program would be housed and to look at their enhancing their existing website to help new businesses with permits and information and other things they might need to get set up to do business in the state. Now, I know this bill isn't exactly what I hoped for, but at least I think it's a good starting point. It gets the ball rolling. It's a good start, and I'm going to make sure that they do that study in the meanwhile and come back with some concrete ways to promote this idea in the next session. Thank you.
All right. Jen, quick questions for Rep. Thatcher.
Good. Representative Thatcher, I introduced a bill, I don't think I talked to you about this, but where it would take all the fines that state agencies assign to business and take them to the general fund rather than go into their own agency. I think we just came up with a funding source for this. If you fine businesses, that money goes to the ombudsman's. Just fine. I want to marry the two bills and see.
Interesting
if
idea.
Yeah. That way, every time they find a business, they're funding the ombudsman's office.
Well, funding helping the businesses.
Yeah. Okay. How would half the agencies operate then?
What's that?
How would half the agencies
exactly
operate? Thank you, Rep. Thatcher. We appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
Jan Meekins.
I have a question for the Rep.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Monroe.
Yeah, I like that you described this feasibility study as getting the ball rolling. Over here in the Senate, we usually say it's kicking the can down the street, but I wish you well.
Thank you.
I think we've all been there when an agency didn't have the same point of view on how much something would cost as we did when we crafted a bill, so I can appreciate that. Jen,
yes.
Please come forward.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Jan Meekins. I'm the state director for NFIB. I'm also the president of Oregon Small Business Coalition. And from our perspective, we very much encourage support of House Bill 2770. I believe that you do have a floor document that we submitted on the other side. But just to say, Senator Shields and members of the committee, that this bill can be very meaningful for business. I do get calls regularly from small business members who have issues with government regulations, government fees, that they do not know where to begin or how to begin to ferret through the labyrinth that can be quite daunting. And for many of these small business owners, this is the only, they've not had any interaction other than by mail or by phone, and this is so much, some of these, resolving some of the issues that come up are very, very involved. Just to give you one example, we have a member, small business owner, new small business owner, had a workers' comp issue. It had gone on for quite some time. It became a runaway train wreck, and when she, it had been, it had mounted up to like $20,000. She was able to, when she did contact the ombudsman, within 3 days it was resolved. This had occurred due to an agency error that she didn't know how to figure out, but in a phone call it was figured out quite readily. The situation got resolved. So that is the effectiveness of an ombudsman. So although it does not go to the extent that we would have liked to have seen, we were looking forward to this being established by the end of this session, that a task force is a really great first step forward. If there's anything that NFIB or OSBC can do in the interim to work with the task force, we would be most happy to do that, and I encourage your support to move the bill forward. Any questions?
Thank you very much for your testimony.
All right. Thank
Would
you.
Anybody else like to testify on House Bill 2778? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2778 and open a work session on House Bill 2778.
Senator George. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2778 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved House Bill 2778 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Debbie, could you please call the roll?
Senator Bonamici.
Excused.
Senator Boquist.
Excused.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Chair votes aye. Motion passes. Senator Monroe, would you carry this bill?
Oh, I guess.
Senator Monroe will be the carrier on House Bill 2770A. Can't have too many rants on a particular day.
I know. You'd be shocked.
That's right. You can still speak to the bill, right?
Right.
You're just not carrying it. All right. So I will close the work session on House Bill 2770A, and I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2425A. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2425A comes to us from the House where it was voted 59-1 by the House. The measure has no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact. It modifies provisions relating to local budget law, eliminating the requirement to publish financial summaries of individual funds, and instead requires a summary of the budget as a whole. The measure requires that the financial summary describe in narrative form the prominent changes from year to year and requires reporting on programs as opposed to funds. The measure standardizes what must be included in the notice of, and budget summary, allows one of the two required publications of the notice to be placed on a website as opposed to a newspaper. It deletes the requirement that a list of personal services costs be included in the budget document and requires the district to make a list of employee salaries available upon request. We have in our packet received from Senator Boquist the -A2 amendment, which clarifies that notices on the Municipal Corporation's website must be maintained for 5 days, must be posted on or before the newspaper's publication date, and must remain there through the date of the meeting in question. It allows for the posting of budget information on the Municipal Corporation's website, provided that certain information is also published in a newspaper. We have received a notice of minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact for the measure as it would be amended by the -A2 amendment, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, Patrick. Could we please bring up George Mears, Mike Eliason, and John Phillips.
Chair Shields and Senator members of the committee. My name is George Mears. I submitted my testimony, and is it proper for me to read what I brought?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. I support House Bill 2425A engrossed with the proposed amendments A2 addressing internet publications during the budget committee and budget hearing phases of local budget law. My interest in seeing these changes stems from my involvement with the Corvallis Rural Fire Protection District as a citizen, a board member for 20 years, and as a treasurer for the past 15 years. The ideas expressed in the proposed amendments are not new. Most recently, they were addressed in House Bill 2828 in 2009. I believe they are ideas whose time have come and should be introduced into local budget law at the same time. The proposed amendments to a engrossed House Bill 2425, they involve deleting the lines 29 through 33 on page 6 of House Bill 2425, and then the insertion of the wording in lines 3 through 13 on page 1 of the amendment, which synchronizes the newspaper publication of the Budget Committee meeting date information with a municipal corporation's website posting of the same information. As an example, it avoids a situation where a newspaper reader sees the website link on the 15th day before the meeting, but the budget officer hasn't had it posted on the website until the 10th day before. Returning to the use of 5 days before as a minimum requirement standardizes the publication requirement between the website and the newspaper. The deleting of lines 24 through 31 on page 8 of House Bill 2425A engrossed, and then the insertion of the wording in lines 14 through 22 on page 1 and lines 1 through 15 on page 2 of the amendment introduces the budget hearing information option and subsequent website publication into the bill. Line 16 of page 2 of the amendment allows for the use of electronic and the providing of copies for the required budget information that may be requested. House Bill 2425 and the amendments in A2 are worthy of your support because they have the potential to save any school district, fire district, or other municipal corporation with a website money. What the Corvallis Rural Fire Protection District has paid during the last 3 years effectively demonstrates the impact of being held captive to too few publication options. These are the billing numbers that I pulled from the line items of the general fund of the CRFPD. For the two budget committee public notices required and published in the Corvallis Gazette Times, $326.85 for the 2010-11 fiscal year ending June 30th, $195.72 for the 2009-10 fiscal year ending June 30th, and $176.26 for the 2008-09 fiscal year ending June 30th. For the single budget hearing public notice and publications of the LB1, LB2s, and LB3s, $1,075.36 for the 2010-11 fiscal year ending June 30th, $820.99 for the 2009-10 fiscal year ending June 30th, and $610.72 for the 2008-09 fiscal year ending June 30th. As written, these amendments will give local governments the option to take advantage of today's technology and effectively communicate with the public on a higher level than is currently required. It's about making the budget information available on as continuous basis as possible. The odds of getting a response to a public notice published in the local newspaper on any given day are minimal at best. The lesson is to educate the public by informing them that they can look for the budget information they seek on the Internet. For those without a computer at home, Internet access is available at the local library or a friend's house. In the past 20 years of my involvement with the CRFPD, and to the best of my recollection, not one person has showed up at a budget committee meeting or budget hearing because they read about it in the Gazette Times. They were either personally invited, interested enough to call the Benton County Clerk's Office, Benton County Assessor's Office, the Benton County Elections Office, or the Fire Department to see when the meeting dates would occur, or more recently they visited the district's website for contact information. I have to believe that the original purpose of requiring the budget committee and budget hearing information to be either mailed or printed in the local newspaper was because they were the best options available when the first local budget law was written. This is no longer true. As newspapers are facing declining readership each year, the best way to reach the public is to encourage government to make the information continuously available through the Internet on a website, just like the Oregon State Legislature makes information available about its matters, and the website link is listed. By passing House Bill 2425 and the attached A2 amendment out of committee, you will provide the legislature and governor the opportunity to give real monetary relief to local government and inform the public about budget matters in a better manner. The Corvallis RFPD would have saved $1,075.36 this year alone if those amendments were enacted before. Please support this bill and these proposed amendments. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Mears, was this your idea and the bill you helped bring forward and get crafted?
Well, as I said in the beginning, it's really not my idea. I've been tracking it for about 10 years. Mm-hmm. It's come up numerous times, and I did work with Dale Allen, the legislative counsel, on crafting the proposed amendments.
Good. Well, thank you for your work on it.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, Mike Eliason with the Association of Oregon Counties. I will speak briefly on some of the background that led to this bill, and I believe there are some folks coming up after us who can get into more of the technical details of the bill. But more or less, this bill is the result of a work group that formed after the passage of Senate Bill 916 during the 2009 session, which had some provisions in it that were helpful to counties, having to do with interfund loans and some other aspects. However, after looking a little bit more closely at the local budget law statutes, it became clear that it's been about a half century since they've had a thorough updating. Some of the language is antiquated and didn't necessarily always conform to current practice. So a work group was formed with the Department of Revenue, the Newspaper Publishers Association, all of the local government, cities, counties, special districts, Department of Education. And we went through dozens and dozens of potential fixes and upgrades and modifications to local budget law. Not every stakeholder got every idea into the bill that they were interested in. However, the final product was a consensus bill that everybody supports. It does a number of things that counties find beneficial. It makes a little bit more clear what is actually published so that it's basically more transparent to the general public, hopefully. It does make incremental strides towards utilization of the Internet. But for this bill, we chose not to focus entirely on publishing on the Internet and bypassing the newspapers. The focus was more on updating the law to make sure it makes sense, that it's readable, that it's transparent. And I will say that there is a sizable population out there that still, especially in rural areas, that either doesn't have the Internet or has very limited access to the Internet. So while we do have an interest in continuing to work towards utilizing the Internet more, there still is definitely a role, I think, for the newspapers. And so with that, we hope you support the bill. Believe the amendment is well-intentioned, but probably not for this bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Phillips of the Oregon Department of Revenue. Thank you. The Local Budget Law Act was an act passed that provided for three criteria for local governments. We've got about 1,400 local governments in Oregon, and any particular citizen might find themselves living in 10 or more of those, on rural areas less. But the three purposes of the Local Budget Law Act were to standardize the practices of all those local governments, to sort of force public input by creating a public citizen budget committee, and three, to make sure that those budgets, when they're crafted, are publicly available or made known for available comment. And so this work group, just as Mike said, was created after 916 from last session, and that bill was kind of focused on counties' budgeting practices. And we had conversations with the counties at that point and said, well, the changes that you're suggesting will affect all of the local governments, small, large, rural, urban. So perhaps we should discuss some of these issues where we have everybody at the table and we can talk about what will work for all a sort of a one-size-fits-all kind of thing, improve the process. We talked a lot about publication. That was one of the main issues, was publication. On one side, you have a lot of people who want to save money by not spending so much on publication. They also want to save time. They want to be more efficient. On the other side, there are people that want to emphasize that actual notice get made. And so the group discussed this, and we came to the conclusion that we could improve local budget law by moving toward better actual notice, not just pro forma notice. And we could also streamline a little bit and save some money. So we think the work group reached consensus on the bill and the passed out of the House, and we think it does those things.
Yeah. Thank you very much for your testimony, gentlemen. Tom Linares and Michelle Hawkins.
Good
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Linhares. I'm the Executive Director of the Multnomah County Tax Supervising and Conservation Commission. What we do for taxing districts in Multnomah County is pretty much the same thing that the Department of Revenue does for the other taxing districts throughout the state. Congratulations, Senator Monroe, on settling your dispute. That's excellent news. The work group sat down in August of 2009, and everybody recognized that local budget law was problematic. The statutes had not been completely reviewed and updated since 1963, but yet every session since then, they've been added to, amended, tweaked, and it had gotten to the point where they were a complete mess. I work with the statutes literally every day, and in some cases I could quote the statute, but when I pulled out the statute book, I couldn't find it because they're just so poorly written and organized. So the first thing we want to do is simply, without changing any policy, make the statutes clear, easier to read, reorder them in a more logical step. That was the first goal. The second goal was to look at areas where maybe minor policy changes could be made to improve the system, to improve transparency, and to make it easier for local governments to complete and execute the budget. The third area we looked at were major policy considerations. As it turned out, we didn't go there. There were a couple of ideas which would have made really sweeping changes to local budget law. We said, no, we're going to stick with the minor stuff. Let's improve what we have and don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. So generally we did that. We probably spent 60-70% of our time on the publication notices, both for the budget committee meeting as well as the notice of public hearing and financial summary. What we did with the financial summary is we looked at it and, with the help of the newspaper publishers actually, said, okay, is this really giving the public the information that is useful to them? And we determined that it wasn't. So what we did is we removed the requirement to detail fund-by-fund information, because some districts have 30, 35, 40 or more funds, some of which are fairly minor, and the current statute requires each one of those to be detailed in the financial summary that's noticed in the newspaper. What we did is we consolidated that down to simply a summary of the total budget. But we expand the information that's required to be included in that summary. There's a detailed listing of revenue, which is not available now, and the requirement side, in addition to by organizational unit, in addition to by object, personal services, materials and services, that sort of thing, we are now going to require, if this bill passes, a summary of organizational unit, including how many FTE are budgeted for each one of those organizational units. Information that's never been required to be published before. So we think that will it'll reduce the cost, but at the same time provide more and better information. So we think it's a win-win situation. If you look through the bill, you'll see a lot of new language relating to school districts and community colleges. That's not new stuff. All that is doing is conforming the statutes to what's currently taking place. School districts budget and produce their appropriation schedules according to the Department of Education requirements. Community colleges do the same thing in accordance with the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. But yet the statutes didn't really specify that. So we just said, well, as long as they're doing it that way, the statute should reflect that. So all of that new language relating to school districts and community colleges is simply conforming the statutes to what is currently taking place. A few other little minor tweaks. Changes after adoption were a big problem. There's about 10 different statutes currently dealing with this. We consolidated those down and made them so they made more sense. Right now, if a governing body amends the budget to reduce the budget by $1, they have to have a public hearing. Yet if they increase requirements by up to 10%, they don't have to have a public hearing. It didn't make any sense. So we consolidated all those and made it more practical and easier for a district, if they're going to amend their budget, to figure out how to go about doing it. So we think it's an excellent bill. All of the groups that were involved are supportive of the bill, and so we ask your support as well. Thank you very much.
Michelle.
This is first and new to me, so Chair Shields and committee members. I am the Linn County Treasurer.
Could you say your name?
Michelle Hawkins, the Linn County Treasurer and Budget Officer, and I'm also here on behalf of Oregon Municipal Finance Officers. I am their past president. So with that, I 16 years ago came to the county as a chief deputy, and 3 years into my employment, my boss back then landed in the hospital and was fighting for her life. In the meantime, we were 3 weeks before budget was to start, and the county commissioners and Ralph Wyatt, our county administrator, came to me and said, is there any way that you could put together a $130 million budget in 3 weeks? With that, I called the Department of Revenue in a panic and said, I do not know budget law, and I do not know where to even begin. And so over the course of the next 3 to 4 weeks, they helped me work my way through it. But in the meantime, I found how cumbersome it was to have to look at the statutes that had been written, realizing that if I went to one section, it told me I could do one thing, and if I went to another section, it would tell me, no, you don't do it that way, you do it a different way. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't realize that it would get me confused until after I got through the whole process. Then Shannon actually came back to the office and showed me how to read the budget law and how to get behind it. Since then, now I'm the treasurer, and now I have districts, my small districts, I have about 75 of them that are in Linn County, have the same problem. They've been thrown into the budget cycle. They may only have 2 to 3 weeks to pull a budget off, and they're at the same point as where I was 15 or 16 years ago. And so when this work group was put together, I was first one to raise my hand and say, I've got to be in the middle of it because I really think that there's got to be some continuity to it. So with that, I feel that everybody came to the table. We all had our own agendas, but I actually feel like the group put their agendas down and went for what was best for Oregon. And so I feel that passing this, and hopefully not with any amendments, because I really am behind the amendment because it sounds good, but my fear is that it won't go all the way through. And right now, it's so important for all of these districts to have it go through so that it gives them clarity in the people that are going to come behind us. And so I would urge you to pass the bill.
Okay. Thank you very much. Would anybody else like to testify on House Bill 2425A? Tom.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher, representing newspaper publishers, and Jeb Ladina of the News Register Guard and I sat for all summer on this work group. I'd like to point out about three things here very quickly for you. You've had a number of public records bills in this room. You've never really had one where local governments, newspapers, and other players sat down for, over a long period of time, had an open, honest discussion between the parties, and worked their way through and came to a conclusion. I think you heard everybody up here say we support. We did deal with internet and new technology, and we've begun to ease our way into that. We did a, newspapers did a survey over the summer, and we collected a national information for this work group. We did 600 people here in Oregon. We found out two basic things. Number one, there's still a significant population that doesn't have internet access, and on other bills we've worked on, AARP has joined with us to talk about the senior population, which doesn't have that. And we also found in this survey that even the majority of people who do use internet access actually don't think about the internet as a place to go for public notice. It's historically been in the newspaper, and if they want to think about public notice, they go for the newspaper for it. So what we have agreed to in this bill, and I think the previous speaker, George Mears, talked about it a little bit, is if you go to page 6 of the bill, the newspapers brought two purposes to this discussion. One was to look at what the publication is and how the public is actually informed of the actions of the budget committee and of the budget. And the second one, is that communication effective? So the two things we did on page 923, we took out or we amended possibly the two newspaper notices of the budget meeting. And we said, put one in the newspaper and one on the Internet. And if you'll notice, it says on line 32 that the newspaper notice contains the Internet website for which the notice is posted. So what we're trying to do is connect that written word in a limited way that goes out to the public and a reference back to the Internet. The purpose of that is when you actually get to the budget summary. The budget summary and all of the details in the budget has a couple of interested groups. One just wants to know what's happening on the big numbers in the county, why you're raising the revenue, are you shifting money out of the road fund into something else? They'll deal with that. There's another very special interested group of people that really dig into the budget, and there is no debate that the amount of information that the local governments can put on their website about their budget is vastly superior to anything going to paper. So we did that on the next page. We agreed to change what was posted in the budget, and it will be a limited amount of information. We expect that will reduce the amount of publication cost by about two-thirds. So we went from one public notice, cut that publication in half. We went to a better communication and more limited information in the newspaper, related it back to the Internet for people to get more information, and came to the conclusion that that would work. We're happy to answer any questions. You guys look like you're ready to go.
We found your testimony tantalizing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's the first time, and I'll be back every day.
Thank you. All right. Any questions? All right. I think what I'll do is, since the amendment was introduced by Senator George, Senator Boquist will give him a chance to weigh in, either behind the scenes or in public in the near future. So I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2425A, and colleagues, we're going to roll over the work session for House Bill 2212A, and we are adjourned.